Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. It's always great having John Cozy back. John is a retired philosophy and logic professor. He's now blogging on social, political, and economic issues. That covers a lot of ground, and he writes terrific articles. He taught for many years, and he's been a writer, taught for about 20 years, been a writer for about another 20. Let me give you his two websites, www.jcozy.com and www.johncozy.mindsay.com. So we'll talk about his latest writing, his view of the world. There is always so much going on. There's never a shortage of important things to talk about. And you know what you get on this program. You get the straight McCoy. You don't get what you get on those other places. No need to identify them. We know them well. John, I welcome you back.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Been an interesting week for me. I have my program Thursdays today and tomorrow, and I was on TV a couple of times this week.
Are you getting to be a star?
Well, I don't know about that, but I guess I must be saying something that somebody wants to hear. But the comment I wanted to throw in was that it's amazing. I was on Press TV, Iranian Press TV. And I was on two other times, and there was a big gap between appearances. Somehow they invited me to two different programs, one on Wednesday and another on Friday. I couldn't believe it. But the point I wanted to make was, with all the beating up we do on Iran, they have brought me on to talk about things that are impossible to discuss honestly in the U.S. media. That if they ever brought me on by mistake and I began saying the things that they let me say freely, they would immediately cut away, they'd break the commercial, and if the host of the program didn't do it, he or she would probably be fired. And here I could say anything I wanted on their TV freely, and I guess they must have liked it, John, because they've invited me back several times.
Well, that's great. That's good news. I want to clear up something though. I haven't used my Mindsay blog site for quite a while. If you want to get my stuff, you got to go to jcozy.com.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll remove that, and I'll just mention the jcozy.com site from now on.
Yeah, it's too many sites. It's just too much administrative work.
plus your different email addresses and pseudonyms.
Yeah.
you threw me with your pseudonym.
I threw Michelle too.
you sent him with the pseudonym.
Yeah, and Julie ended up scolding me, and she was right.
Well, I think I mentioned this to you in an email once when I first began writing. I have an academic friend in Chicago, and he mentioned how hard it is for new writers to break in to get anybody to pay attention to him. And I mentioned that I wonder if that's the problem Samuel Clemens once had. So
yep.
He changed his name to Mark Twain, and now that he isn't using it anymore, maybe he wouldn't mind if I take it. that would attract a little attention, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, John, your newest article you call Linguistic Nonsense and Liberal Economics. Your articles make so much sense. They really do. One comment, and then I'll let you talk about your article. Oh, some weeks back, it's been quite a while now. Economist Michael Hudson came on the program. He had written an article discussing the difference between today's junk economics, the kind they feature on CNBC and Bloomberg, and classical economics, Adam Smith and those people. Those people believe that the way to grow an economy, you needed to grow it productively versus the stuff that gets kicked around today, bailing out bankers and that sort of thing, and cutting wages and social benefits and, you know, harming the many to help the few. But classical economics was just the opposite of that. But you talk about linguistic nonsense and liberal economics. Explain what you wrote about.
Well, you know, I've been studying language for a long, long time. And it became obvious to me many, many, many decades ago that a lot of things people say just don't make any sense, except that people don't pay attention to what people say. And it occurred to me one evening, sitting around here thinking about things, that this so-called economy that we have is extremely uneconomical. It involves enormous amounts of waste and degradation and creation of junk, et cetera, et cetera. And my knowledge of the language told me that uneconomical economy makes no sense. That's an oxymoron. It's a contradiction. And so in the piece, what I did was, I also know as a logician that once a contradiction enters a system, contradictions can't be contained. They pop up all over the place, everywhere, and the nonsense proliferates. So I wrote this piece based on, four or five, six different scenarios in which I think I was able to show, or I think I was able to demonstrate, that there's no direct relationship whatsoever to the real economy, that is, the economy of goods and services that people use, and the monetary economy that economists concern themselves with and measure. And in doing that, I was able to list a whole bunch of many more oxymorons that have become current in usage, and nobody recognizes them as contradictions that are meaningless. And so, I knocked out that piece. I don't know what kind of reception it's going to get. Haven't heard or got any comments back yet. But
I get some comments on mine. I don't get a flood of them. I guess I should be grateful for that, John. If I got dozens of responses to every article, I wouldn't have enough time to write more articles.
Yeah, that's true. But I get responses to my articles, from people all over the world, which I appreciate. I get more responses from foreigners than I do from Americans, but that's fine. It doesn't bother me a bit.
Oh, I get them from around the world as well, and it can come from anybody. It can come from high school kids. It can come from professors like you, from doctors, from lawyers. I mean, there are all kinds of people, and it really is wonderful. I get enough to make me feel that I'm doing something right that people may want. I think another way to tell how we receive, John, how many reposts do we get? If other sites pick up what we do, then maybe they like it and they want to circulate it. And I seem to get a fair number of reposts. I mean, stuff ends up on sites I never heard of.
Yeah, I get a bunch too, but trying to find out whether or not they're reposting is difficult. It's not hard. A lot of them repost without telling you, and they turn up. I mean, that's fine. I don't have any problem with that. The more reposts I get, the better. But it's hard to know how many of them there are.
Oh, well, that's exactly right, and I guess some can be in other languages that if you do a Google search, you may not even find them.
Oh, yeah, a lot of my stuff turns up translated into Greek, comes out of Athens somewhere, which is interesting.
One time somebody told me that they spotted, I don't know where they found this stuff, that they spotted one or more of my articles translated into Mandarin Chinese, also Greek, also Russian. I've seen it. Somebody sent me a link of an article in Farsi, in Arabic. My goodness gracious. Again, I'm delighted.
Yeah. But, I've got this thing about misuse of language and how it's misused by the power structure to manipulate people and how people are just unconscious when that happens to them, and it's not just from economists or politicians. There's an ad on TV right now for Advil, for instance, that goes like this: Advil has the strength to relieve arthritis pain all day. And I say, well, what the hell? It doesn't say it relieves arthritis pain. You know, you got to listen carefully to what they're saying. I mean, Charles Atlas may have been able to lift a ton, but doesn't prove he ever did. You know. You hear that kind of stuff all the time in America, and I say to myself, you know, if Americans had to understand the English language to get a citizenship, most Americans would have to emigrate to some foreign country because, you know, we don't understand our own language.
Well, that's very true. I guess English is English is not the easiest language. When you have words, some words that have so many different meanings, and it's very easy to misuse them. Even people like you and me, John, maybe not you, but me, I have to think very carefully about some of the words I use and think about them and even check, is this the word I really want to use to say I'm trying to say?
Yeah, sure. You know, I do that all the time. As a matter of fact, the only books I have on my desk are books that can be used for that purpose.
Well, I don't have any books for that purpose, but you know linguistics and you know logic, and I just struggle. I guess anyone who writes struggles to want to try to say it in the clearest way. If you only write letters or things like that or send emails, you don't worry about that. You do it very quickly and jot them off. But if you're writing an article you want people to read, I know I feel this way. I want to say things as clearly as I can. I want to communicate well, so I want to use the language well and make it as simple as possible. And I'd like to write to the level of kids in high school, so that a high schooler can read anything I write and understand what I'm saying. If I can do that, I feel that I'm accomplishing something.
Yeah, that's good. That's an accomplishment. I don't think I can manage that. But
I don't know. Your articles are very easy to understand, and you pick important topics. The one you wrote before the present, the last two I got, the one before, you talked about a corpulent country. I mean, that struck a chord for me as well, John, and also the fact, you get into the topic of junk foods and the wrong foods, and that takes me one step further, polluted foods, and one step further takes me right to the Gulf of Mexico that I've written about a number of times. And I say unequivocally, and I have no doubt in the world that it's 100% accurate, absolutely nothing from that Gulf should be eaten. The Gulf of Mexico is a toxic sea, and the garbage coming out of the government that 75% of the oil is gone, it's all still there. Nobody can see it because dispersing means that they hide it, they don't get rid of it. But the toxicity there is terrible. So imagine eating a fish dinner in a fancy restaurant, something that came from the Gulf.
You'd have to say that there's something fishy about that.
There is something fishy about that. Something we'll have to add one more meaning to the word fishy, mm-hmm. meaning unfit to eat, because that certainly is the case.
Okay. But the point of the article on linguistic nonsense in economics was that, you know, the phrase uneconomical economy may sound like it makes sense to some people, but it's exactly like the phrase unhappy happiness, which no one would pay any attention to. You know,
that's
and that's the kind of dumbness that we're faced with from our economics profession in the United States all the time, and I don't know why they continue to do it. I mean, I don't know whether they're just dumb, poorly educated, or scoundrels, but I suspect it's because classical economics, or what's known as liberal economics, is really a religious-like dogma. They believe it to the core, regardless of what the reality shows. and like, you know, like I had in my paper, you know, a Bible reference there, you know, God separated night from day before he created the sun and the stars, you know. People believe that even today, and that's incredible, but I don't know what to do about it.
Well, indeed, people believe all kinds of things, and usually they get their information in the wrong places, John, and the lies spread very quickly, the misinformation, the untruths, and even just getting back to economics, the emphasis we place on some things that bear no relationship to the lives of people, of most people. So everybody knows what GNP is, but what on earth does GNP have to do with a person's individual situation, welfare, whether they have a job or not? If they have a job, what kind is it? Is it bringing in enough income? Can they support their family properly? Are they living through a situation where maybe their home is in jeopardy of being foreclosed? And then you talk in your article, you go into the nonsense about adding to the GDP by, and you gave an example in Dallas where they'll tear down sports stadia and build new ones.
So, yeah, it doesn't add anything to the real economy. It adds the GNP GDP, which I shortened in my paper to GP. But again, it's all a matter of you know, they get away with this simply because people do not pay attention to the language. When somebody says big sale today, you know, you're going to save so and so percent, and I say to myself, who the hell, you know, is listening to this that doesn't understand that spending and saving are opposites? You're not going to save a penny by going out and buying something. But you know, the whole culture is that way. And it's interesting that no prominent economist has ever gone on TV and said, hey, people, this is a lie.
Oh, I'd love to hear that.
Nobody has done it. Which, you know, and I say to myself, what kind of people are these people, you know, who've given us economic advice who won't even go on television and tell people that this is a lie?
Well, do you remember after 9/11, George Bush, in a public statement of some kind, I don't know if he went on TV or...
Yeah, he said, go out and spend.
Go out and spend.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to solve the problem of being attacked, and of course the official story was a pack of lies from A to Z, another topic altogether. But the way to solve that problem is go to the mall and buy.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine people not absolutely choking over a comment like that?
Yeah, you know, well, you know, I had something in my article that I took out. I was going to blame the whole controversy on a broken university system. And I was going to point out that George W. Bush is the only president who has received earned degrees from two prestigious American universities, Harvard and Yale. And I said to myself, you know, there's not a single Harvard or Yale professor or university administrator who has ever expressed any shame in having granted him earned degrees.
Well, that's right, John. Of course, they wouldn't dare, and I'm sure the Bush family contributes well to the endowment fund
of
both schools.
Yeah, you know, which makes the university system just as corrupt as the political system.
And
as a former, you know, academic, that really galls me. It galls me.
Well, Harvard put a hack by the name of Larry Summers, had him as their president, and they finally had to get rid of him because he did such outrageous things while he was there, like demean women and claim that the third world should be used as a waste dump for the worst toxins we want to get rid of, not even put them in our own landfills like nuclear waste, dump them in Africa or someplace. I mean, he made public statements like that.
And where is he today?
A heartbeat away from we know where.
You know, I mean, he's not Larry Summers, he's Larry Arctic Winter.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, but you know, it's again, nobody ever listens and says, hey, wait a minute, that can't be right, you know? And it's simple if you just pay attention to the language. Supreme Court does the same thing, of course. You know, I've argued this before. They substitute words in the Constitution, which words they pull out of the blue, you know? And say that the Constitution, the word in the Constitution isn't what the Constitution meant. The word in the Constitution is the one that we're going to substitute for it. And they get away with it. Thomas Jefferson recognized that the Supreme Court, after Madison versus Marbury, was, you know, was corrupting the Constitution, but nobody paid attention to him. It's just amazing to me, you know, what kinds of things have gone on in this country.
Well, absolutely. When you talk about corrupted language, John, on something that isn't economics, but one of ones, I don't know if this is the worst example. If I could think about all the ones that might pop into my head after this program is over, but I know one of the ones that absolutely turns my stomach and turns me cold inside is when we in our foreign wars of aggression. We slaughter innocent people, civilians, and destroy so much just indiscriminately, and we've heard to all of it as collateral damage.
Oh yeah, but you know, there are even worse ridiculous contradictions. I mean, the WikiLeaks thing, and they named a couple of Afghans apparently who had turned coat and come over to the American side. And what does the Pentagon say? Well, these people's lives are in danger. It was put in danger by WikiLeaks. Hell, it wasn't put in danger by WikiLeaks. They're put in danger by Americans trying to turn them. You know,
that's exactly right. And
I mean, we're not concerned. The Pentagon isn't concerned about those people. They couldn't care less if they get killed tomorrow. What they're concerned about is that if those guys get killed tomorrow, it's going to be harder for the Pentagon to turn some others. That's all they're concerned about. You know, this kind of disingenuousness that reeks through our society. I don't know. We have forgotten the old ancient aphorism. A liar is disbelieved when he tells the truth. You know?
That's exactly right, John. I wanted to throw one more comment in. Not only does the Pentagon not care about whoever their Afghan informers may be, they don't care about U.S. troops. These young kids, they recruit these young kids. We have a poverty draft because we have such a rotten economy that isn't getting better, it's getting worse. And kids can't find a job, and we don't educate them so they're trained to do anything more than menial stuff anyway. So to bring in some income, they join the service, and we send them over to foreign wars to get their heads blown off, or if they come back in one piece, to come back with PTSD. We're averaging a suicide or more every single day. So many are injured we never hear about. I think there are many killed we don't hear about either. I'm sure the families are informed at some point or other, but it doesn't make the headlines. And we don't care about these kids. We just recruit more of them to send them over there to get their heads blown off. And we don't even give them the benefits that the recruiters tell them they'll get by joining the service. This is the kind of country we are.
Oh, there's a piece about that on my website. I wrote it a long time ago, so I don't remember the exact title anymore or where on my website it is, but there's a search tool on my website. People could search for it if they want. But my point was, and I'm a veteran, and I know this from experience, countries take people that are expendable and send them off to war. They don't send people off to war who they don't consider expendable. So if those people are lucky enough to come back, their expendable status hasn't changed. They're still expendable. So that their benefits that they were promised, they don't get. The honor they were promised, they don't get. Veterans Day comes along, and they have to work while bankers and government people who have never served have a day off.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. George Bush never went to war during the Vietnam conflict. Dick Cheney never went to war.
Well, Dick Cheney, you know, even said he had other priorities. So
he had other priorities.
You know, and I've got a piece about that on there too somewhere. I think it's called the Cheney Gene. You know, it's you know, a rubber backbone and a yellow belly.
Well, I hope he read it, John. I hope he read it.
No, I'm sure he didn't.
Well, a lot of these folk, well, now there hasn't been a draft since the early 1970s. So these people have no problem. I mean, they can get out of it altogether. But Cheney was old. He was draft bait when we did have a draft. I think he used a medical reason to get out of it.
Whatever, you know. The interesting thing in that article that I point out was it's not only Cheney and Bush, but I for all the prominent neocons that I could name, only one had any military service.
Which one?
I don't remember. You'd have to look at my article.
Well, they probably didn't get on the front lines having to...
Well, you know, I don't think he did, but nevertheless, you know, he at least had military service. The others had none at all.
Well, I know Ronald Reagan was in the service during World War II, but what was he doing?
He made movies.
He made movies.
Yeah.
He made movies.
Yeah.
By the way, your line about telling lies, Alec Coburn, who co-editor of Counterpunch, in one of his books, he had a great line about Ronald Reagan. And if I can say it right, I think he said, Reagan never told a lie and never told the truth because he never could tell the difference between the two. He was famous for telling stories about things that never happened. But
Well, that's true. But there's one thing I'll give Ronald Reagan credit for. When he was talking about his college education, he said he studied economics. He also said, but it didn't take. You know, nothing else took either, but that's beside the point.
I nearly met him one time when I was working in California and he was governor. We put on events in hotels, John, and once in a while we like to get somebody down to give a little talk to the assembled group. And he was almost set to come down one time because we had a group of young officers soon to exit the military. He was a big supporter of the military. This was in the 1960s. And he was all set to come, as far as I understood. But then a conflict came up, and he couldn't make it. I ended up with the mayor of San Diego, who was a first-class jerk.
Well,
that's another story altogether.
I'll tell you, I was in the political consulting business for a short time on the side, and I wrote all the speeches and planned a campaign for an attorney general who evicted a long-term holder of that office, and I went to an attorneys general conference in Lake Tahoe or somewhere. Yeah, it was Lake Tahoe, I guess, and all of these, you know, big wig state attorneys general in this big room, and in walks I don't know, the actor who played Little Joe on Bonanza.
Oh, I know who you mean. I forget his name.
And all of these big wig powerful attorney generals ran like schoolgirls to get his autograph and shake his hand. And I sat there and I said to myself, what kind of baloney is this, you know? And the person that I had helped elect him, are you going to go over and talk to Little Joe? And I said, hell no, I don't want to talk to an actor.
Well,
you know,
I feel
but
the same
that's,
way.
That's the kind of nonsense that, you know, an actor who doesn't do anything but learns a script that somebody else writes and goes out, you know, and then plays a part, gets credited as being somehow or other somebody worth noticing and paying attention to.
Well, exactly, John.
This, you know, I don't know whether you remember Plato's Republic or not.
Barely.
If there was ever a country that was described by Plato's cave, this is it.
And likely a whole lot worse. There is only one actor I've ever had on my program, and it had nothing to do with his acting. It had to do with his activism. and that was Mike Farrell, the guy from MASH. He has become very activist, anti-war, anti-death penalty, and we didn't say two words about what he did on MASH when he came on. We talked strictly about the activism and the issues that that he gives talks on and so on. I'd be happy to have a person. I didn't care that he was an actor. I cared about what he stood for.
I hear the music playing. Is there a break or an end?
Let's take a quick break, John, and you can grab a sip of water, and then we'll be right back.
Okay, doke.
PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is an emergency. No, it isn't. It's an urgency. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com with a new show called News Dissector. It's built on the blog that I do every day for MediaChannel.org, dissecting news, analyzing what's happening in the world, offering very cool music and great guests. Thursdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Be there or be square.
This is Mark Rudd, host of Doing the Spadework, an ongoing conversation about organizing, talking with a variety of organizers from around the country who are out there doing the spadework, who are building the basis for the coming social and political movement, what you might call the new civil rights movement. Please join us each week to hear good conversation every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, Progressive Radio Network.
Shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
John Cozy, talking about linguistic nonsense and liberal economics and assorted other topics. John, I don't want to get into it, but I'll just mention that I put out a new article today. I've written several times on WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning in one article. I put another one out on Manning today. It was the topic of one of the reasons that they had me on Press TV on Wednesday. And it inspired me to want to write an article just on Manning. I call it Bradley Manning, colon, an American hero. And anyone can read it. Hopefully it'll get a good number of posts. but it's on my blog site, and I really mention that. The way to find my blog is simply Google Steve Lendman blog. That's a lot easier than the formal way. That's the way I access it, and it's the new article dated today, and I write it about him and what he did, and it was heroic. He made a big mistake telling somebody who turned him in, but what he did and what WikiLeaks does is really heroic. And you said it earlier in the program, John, the crimes committed are not by these people telling us important truths we need to know. The crimes are by our own government waging illegal wars and killing people, committing war crimes, torture, all the rest. Those are the crimes, and those are the things that need to be exposed. People need to know about this. It's our country. Do we want it run by criminals, or do we want it run by honest people? Well, it can only be the latter if we work for it, and it starts with finding out the truth, what's going on. So I wanted to honor Bradley Manning. He's in the brig
at
Quantico, Virginia now, the Marine base.
Yeah, I know. I don't know what can be done in a country like ours when the corporate world owns all the media, and you really can't get anywhere. But you know, there's this heart-rending story that's been on the news the last couple of days about this Afghan woman who had her ears and nose cut off by her Taliban husband, and you know, has now been rescued by some American servicemen or whatever and brought to America, and she's going to get reconstructive surgery and all that, and everybody's talking about how wonderful this is. And I say, yeah, okay, you know, that's nice for that woman. I'm glad, you know, that's happening to her. But at the same time, nobody is bemoaning the hundreds and perhaps thousands of Afghani women and children who have been killed and maimed, you know. So women, we save one and kill a million, and oh boy, aren't we wonderful people? And I don't know what's wrong with us.
Oh well, I agree fully, John. And this is what we do, whether we're talking about Afghanistan or Iraq or Haiti. We talk about we rescue a few orphans from Haiti. We bring over an Afghan woman or man or child or whatever, an Iraqi, and we simply ignore the fact that we're committing mass slaughter and destruction over there.
Yeah.
It completely ignored. It's not a story that will ever get on airtime. The only solution I have to the corporate media, John, they certainly own we own the airwaves. They have stolen them from us. They're the public airwaves, but you'd never know that. I mean, that's officially what they are. But they've taken them over. The government gave it to them for nothing. Maybe that's a greater theft than what Wall Street got from the Treasury. Considering how long they've had them, and all for nothing, but the only way to beat them is to tune them out. If everyone realized that all you get is rubbish when you turn on corporate TV or read corporate publications, don't buy the publications, don't watch their programs, they will. There's no defense against that. That's my answer.
Well, you know that's all very well and true, but I don't think people are likely to do that. The thing that I don't understand is that if I can see the nonsense in rescuing one while killing a million, why can't other Americans, you know, notice it too?
I mean, oh, for sure.
What has happened to our people? I just don't get it at all. But I'd like to get back to my other article, the obesity article.
Okay.
Because it had three parts. The first part was, yeah, there's an obesity crisis in America. It's caused by processed food companies, you know, loading their stuff with sugar, salt, and fat, and all kind of stuff to make it taste good, so it sells a lot, and that sort of thing. We're talking about, you know, it's now a national security issue, or young kids aren't fit for military service, and all of that. And I said to myself, yeah, and it'll never be solved. Why? Because although you go to your doctor and he'll tell you you need to lose weight, he makes money off of every fat patient who comes to him and every disease that the obesity causes. The drug companies make enormous amounts of money from treating these afflictions. The diet food industry, the diet book industry, the places, you know, the gyms that, that sell exercise, you know, and exercise equipment. All of these people are making money off of this sickness, okay, that would be out of business if people in America were healthy. So, you know, people in America aren't going to be healthy. The corporate world isn't going to change. There's too much money to be made out of sick people. There's no money to be made out of healthy people. And then I went on, you know, from that to our infrastructure is collapsing and nobody's doing anything to maintain it. Why? Because there's more money to be made in cleaning up the rubble and rebuilding after a catastrophe than there is in maintaining the infrastructure to prevent the catastrophe. And then I went on to the wars. You know, we now have private firms doing all sorts of support for our troops. But why would anybody expect those private firms to want to end the war? The day the war ends, their cash cow dies. So when you hear about, contractors paying off the Taliban to let the supplies through, I say to myself, they're not paying off the Taliban to let the supplies through. They're paying off the Taliban to keep the Taliban fighting, because the day the Taliban stops fighting, the cash cow dies. It's the same syndrome. It's obesity. It's infrastructure. It's war. It's all done for profit. It's not done for people. Nope. And even in military industrial complex, we have all these extremely expensive, high technological weapons that work pretty well, okay, but they don't work well enough to turn the tide of battle. You think that's not planned?
Well, I agree, John, and a couple of times I quoted Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense in the 1960s under Lyndon Johnson, informing Johnson in the mid-1960s that the Vietnam War could not be won. Johnson realized the Vietnam War could not be won. It took another 10 years before it finally ended, when the infamous helicopter from the roof of the U.S. Embassy out of Saigon, as the North was heading into the city and they were evacuating the people they wanted to save and didn't give a damn about the rest, and the North came in and just to unify the country. And the war never had to be fought, never should have been fought. The North's leader, Ho Chi Minh, he just wanted a good relationship, not a hostile one. The Taliban never wanted war with us. Saddam, as awful as he was, never wanted war with us. Never threatened us.
He was our buddy.
he was our buddy in the 1980s. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, who was it? Henry Kissinger said that to be an enemy of the United States is dangerous. To be a friend is fatal.
Was that Kissinger?
I think so.
I certainly wouldn't want to be his friend. I'm afraid that would be a very unhealthy relationship. He is not somebody. He's one of the all-time unheroes, if there's such a word. An infamous guy going back decades.
Oh yeah. But you know that's the duplicity of what's happening in America. It's just so bad. I was listening to Obama yesterday, and he talked about what the private sector has 7 months in a row now created jobs, okay? And the creation last month was, 71,000 or something, which is, dropping the bucket. And I said, Mr. President, if you had any brains, you would realize that statement would be true if the private sector had increased employment by one job per month over 7 months. And that is not, you know, worth talking about.
Well, it's not worth talking about. We have a population of well over 300 million
yeah,
people.
But my point was, you know, that because it's 71,000, he thinks that's good. But nobody would think it would be good if it were one. But the statement is true under either condition. I mean, people just don't pay attention to what's being said.
And this and the number that they put out, John, is
it's probably a lie.
Oh, well, they have a formula where they estimate it plus or minus hundreds of thousands. So in other words,
this is probably the result of a poor educational system. Most people don't know how a percentage rating is calculated, but you know the unemployed 131,000 people were added to the unemployment list, you know, the rate stays at 9.5%. And I say to myself, well, the only way you can do that mathematically is subtract 131,000 from the denominator of the equation. You know, what happened to those 131,000 people? Did they die, disappear, what? You know, the whole thing is so damn nonsensical. I mean, grade school kids ought to know that can't be done. But, you know, Americans, and then, you know, the media, you know, proclaims it. And
well,
I say
that's
to
exactly
myself,
right. And then they revise the numbers two or three times. So far in recent months, every revision, John, they have lowered the numbers.
Yeah.
So the report before the present one, I think the number was something. Might have been 70 or 80,000 jobs created on report number one. On report number two, it was down to 30,000. Maybe on report number three, it'll be down to zero.
Yeah.
And the way those people disappear, John, is if when whoever shows up in the survey, if they ask you, have you looked for a job in the last 30 days? And if you say no, then you effectively get disappeared.
I know that, and I say to myself, how the hell do we know these surveys are truthful?
Oh,
I mean,
well, that's true too.
They say that so many people said no. Why should I believe that? If they need to subtract 131,000 from the denominator, why don't they just subtract 131,000 for the denominator and say, hey, that's how many people said so.
Well, there's an economist who was on this program once, and it's been a long time. I'm going to have to get him back, John Williams. He reverse engineers the government data. He goes back to the way it used to be calculated when they at least made an effort to do it accurately. I may have the date wrong, but I think he calculates the employment number based on the 1980 formula, so going back 30 or so years. And his unemployment figure is, I haven't looked at it since the last report, but I think the one before that, before the present report, the unemployment figure, the true one, is 22%.
Yeah,
22%
sure.
Unemployment, yeah. Not this fictitious 9.5.
Yeah. Yeah, you're talking about revising the economic numbers, but that's not just something that's done by economists or the government. Just think of what happens, in Afghanistan when the Afghanistanis say, "Hey, you just killed so many civilians," and the Pentagon always denies it. No, they were insurgents, okay? And that's what the news reports. The Pentagon denies it, and then two or three days or a week or so later, you'll find out that the Pentagon admits we did it, okay? And we're going to pay the families of the murdered, okay? And I say and we apologize. We didn't mean to do this. And I say, look, don't you realize that those apologies are hollow? If you're really sorry about doing something, you don't do it again. And if you do it over and over again, you sure in hell aren't sorry. It's that kind of thing that goes on in this country, and I don't understand it. I don't understand what kind of people we've become.
Well, we have become a sorrowful people, John, and again, what disturbs you, and it certainly disturbs me greatly, that most people in the country simply don't understand it. They seem indifferent to it. Even people who understand enough to realize there's something rotten going on, they're so consumed with their personal lives that people who at times might even go out to a protest, say an anti-war protest, and then they'll go back and they'll maybe go to the movies or go to dinner. Well, what kind of activism is that? I mean, that's not going to solve any problem. The only way things will change, the only way things can possibly change, is if we make a great enough effort to do it. And we're literally being betrayed by our government. Doesn't make any difference whether it's a Republican or a Democrat government. I expected nothing from Obama. The only surprise I got, John, was I expected it to be awful. The only surprise I got was he turned out to be worse than I expected.
Yeah, you know, we only have one political party in America. It's called the Republicrat.
Oh, what Gore Vidal calls the money party.
I like Republicrat.
Republicrats. Yeah. Well, we both know what we're talking about, indeed so. And they support power and privilege, and they simply don't give a damn about most people in the country. And we call ourselves a democracy. Some democracy, John.
Yeah. Another thing, you know, there's this guy Ryan. Now this guy running for office or something named Ryan, Ryan.
Oh, I'm not certain who you mean.
He's come out, you know, he's against social programs and against Social Security and all that kind of stuff. And he says that we're becoming, you know, socialists in a socialist state. And I said to myself, you know, why doesn't he realize that the only reason that social programs are required is because the economy fails to provide what people need? And he supports the economy, but not the social programs. So what in the world is going to become of that if his recommendations ever get put into effect? The place will collapse. And it doesn't take a genius to understand that, you know. But apparently he doesn't, and he looks like he might get elected to office.
Oh, is he running for the House or the Senate?
I think he's running for the House, but I'm not sure.
Well, one congressman can't do all that much harm, but the problem is that mindset is shared by an awful lot of other people.
Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. You know, it's but the dumbness of it is what bothers me. I mean, you know, if the economy doesn't provide for people and the government doesn't provide for people, then your country collapses.
John,
it's as simple as that.
The closest analogy to what we're going through now economically is the 1930s, and I think I think in a year, two, three ahead, we'll go through a very long, terrible economic period, and then at some point we'll look back and compare it to the 1930s. Well, in the 1930s, FDR was not perfect, far from it, but we got some wonderful programs in the 1930s. He had a program to create jobs. He put an awful lot of people who, I mean, he really created jobs. He took the unemployment rate down from 25% or more and got it down to something like 11%, which was still awful, but that was a heck of an improvement, where now the Obama administration literally is trying not to create. They claim they're creating jobs, but literally their program is not to create jobs.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a brother who was in the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. 1930s.
Yeah, I know all about all that.
Well, I'm not old enough to remember. I lived through the 1930s.
I gave away my age, didn't I?
Well, I was born in 1934, but I was too young to know what was going on. And my parents seemed like everything was very normal and ordinary with them. But, you know, what the heck does a 3-, 4-, 5-year-old know? You don't know anything at all. But those were hard times. My father very luckily had a job, so food was kept on the table. But for a few years, we had to live with my mother's parents because I guess times were very, very rough.
Yep, I remember those times.
I'm afraid we're going through it again, John. We're in the early stages.
We had some guests over to dinner last night, some our relatives, and we were talking, and I was telling them about the 1930s. I lived in a little community in Pennsylvania that was made up principally of immigrant families. There were Scotch, Irish, and many from Eastern Europe, Italians, Tyroleans, sort of thing. We had no policemen. No one was ever robbed. Okay? Never locked our doors. If someone got sick, like the woman a woman in a household in the community got sick, everybody else gathered around. They took food in every day until she was better. They went and they cleaned her house. They dressed her clothes, her kids, and for school, and all of those things took place. Nobody ever went hungry in that community. If they didn't have food, others provided it. Today in America, you couldn't find a place like that if you dug all the way to hell. So things are worse today in America than they were in the 30s.
Oh, they absolutely are. And if you go to developing nations, John, I hear stories. I've never been and experienced it firsthand. But in some developing nations, if you really want to see the way people live in under terrible conditions, you'll meet people that are really in deep poverty, and they'll invite you into their homes as an honored guest and take food that they barely, that they don't have enough of to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
And give it, they'll feed you before feeding themselves.
Yeah. The other day when Bill Gates and Warren Buffett had announced this big charitable thing that billionaires were going to give half their fortunes to charitable organizations, or established charitable organizations, of course, which are crooked anyhow. I thought to myself, Americans don't understand the meaning of the word charity. There's an old Russian aphorism that says, charity is sharing a bone with a dog when you're as hungry as it is.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that a wonderful?
Oh, that is wonderful. That's right.
Yeah. And the rest of the world knows that. It's only Americans that don't know it. If I give $100 to the Red Cross, I get a tax deduction. If I give $100 in food to my neighbor who's hungry, I don't get nothing. What a racket is that?
It is a racket. It's a racket, and it's a terrible way that we've developed through the years, where literally the ideology is to take from the have-nots and give it to the haves, and the haves can never get enough, and I guess what they want is everything, and let the have-nots end up with nothing. What kind of a system is that? My goodness, that wasn't the way I was raised, and I simply can't accept that, John.
I can't either. But I've written in an article somewhere or other that Adam Smith's invisible hand is a pickpocket. And the other day I said to somebody, there's only one thing the rich in this country don't understand, and that is that even they and their government can't pick an empty pocket.
And the pocket is getting emptier all the time.
Yeah, right, yeah,
I mean, people for a number of years were able to use their homes as an ATM machine and their credit card for the same thing. But those days are over now.
Yeah.
And we're literally levitating. And if the Federal Reserve didn't spend trillions of dollars buying U.S. treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, then the economy would have fallen apart before now. They're just pumping liquidity in to keep it elevated, but it's a losing game because this is no way to grow an economy. There's only one way to grow it, and that's the old-fashioned way. You make productive economic investments that grow the economy, that produce jobs, that lift all boats.
Our
system sinks most of them and only lifts the select few.
And General Motors just put that philosophy into effect by announcing that they were going to invest $500 million in an auto plant in Mexico.
Oh, lovely! Good for General Motors.
Yeah.
Our money supporting them, and they don't give a damn about creating jobs in this country. John, I don't hear the theme music going, but I know it's reached the time when we're at an end. Ah, there it is. There is another program coming on after this one. I always feel if the next host doesn't show up and they want me to keep going, I will be happy to do it. But John, as always, terrific discussion. I look forward to next time. It's always a to be continued with you.
Okay, Stephen, nice talking to you. I hope our listeners were enlightened.
Well, they always are when you come on. My great thanks. I'll shoot you an email.
Okie doke.
Thank you, John.
Bye-bye.
Bye.